From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Laura Linney. She was nominated for an Oscar this year for her starring role in You Can Count on Me. Now she's returning to her role as Marianne Singleton in the third cycle of Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City series. Further Tales of the City premieres Sunday on Showtime. Also, Iranian film director Bahman Farmanara, after having 10 of his screenplays rejected by Iranian censors, he's made his first film in 20 years. That film, Smell of Camphor, Fragrance of Jasmine, stars Farmanara as a director making a movie about his own funeral. Also, part 4 in Kevin Whitehead's Avant-Garde Made Easy series, this time pianist Cecil Taylor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The GOP leadership in Congress was expecting to move a compromise budget plan through the House and on to the Senate today, but so far that's not proving to be easy. NPR's David Wilner has been watching this process all day. David, what's been holding this compromise up?
Well, Corey, there was supposed to be an agreement about this budget. In fact, President Bush went out to the Rose Garden twice this week to say that there had been an agreement on Capitol Hill. But in fact, I guess Republicans found that not all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted when they actually got down to writing their final budget compromise. Now, this is a budget that both the House and the Senate have to agree on. They both have to vote on the same budget. They voted on separate budgets that didn't agree. They found that there were disagreements that persisted through the day. The House was supposed to vote on it this morning and the Senate was supposed to vote on it this afternoon. But so far, the House has yet to take it up.
So when are we likely to see a budget agreement, and what will it mean when we do?
Well, the House may vote on it tonight. There may be something by midnight. The Senate would then have to take it up. It's not clear whether they're going to do it in the wee hours of the morning, if they're going to meet again tomorrow, Friday, a day when they normally don't like to meet. They like to go home. But there could be an agreement by the weekend. Once that's reached, it would then allow the Senate to go ahead and craft tax cuts. They have to have a budget before they do that. And the size of this budget that they're haggling over right now is actually something that's not law. It's not binding. It's more than anything a guideline for how much money the appropriators will eventually spend later this year.
Thank you. NPR's congressional correspondent David Wilner. Federal agents in Los Angeles say they've broken up an immigrant smuggling ring that allegedly brought hundreds of people from Ukraine into the United States through Mexico. NPR's Mondelit Del Barco reports.
The FBI arrested 11 people believed to have been leading the smuggling ring. Several more remain fugitives. Authorities say they charged hundreds, perhaps thousands of Ukrainians $7,000 or more to immigrate illegally into the country. They arrived by boat, in the trunks of cars, or on foot across the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. Attorney Dan Saunders says some of them were even forced into prostitution.
Several women report that they were involuntarily sold to be prostitutes until such time as their fee had been paid off.
Border Patrol agents were tipped off when they found a home videotape documenting the journey of one Ukrainian family. For 2 years, they worked with INS agents and the FBI to track down the ringleaders. They could face as much as 3 years in prison for every immigrant they smuggled. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 80 points to close at 10,796 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 74 points, or 3.3%. This is NPR News. Hollywood writers and producers are back at the bargaining table, working for a second day after the expiration of the writers' contract. Both sides are sticking to a news blackout on the talk, so it's not clear whether they've made progress on issues such as the residual payments writers earn when their movies and TV programs are resold as reruns. Britain's prime minister says foot-and-mouth disease in the country is being brought under control. Mark Savage reports from London.
Today was the day Tony Blair had hoped to hold a British election, but instead of hitting the campaign trail, he spent the past 2.5 months battling the livestock disease foot and mouth. Now, however, the Prime Minister says the worst is over. No more funeral pyres will be lit after today, and the backlog of animals awaiting slaughter and disposal is almost cleared. But Blair warned the country not to drop its guard.
It is not over yet. We cannot in any way be complacent. and it is essential that we remain vigilant.
Altogether, there have been more than 1,500 cases of foot-and-mouth disease since the first diagnosis was confirmed on the 20th of February. Although the main impact has been on the farming community, the crisis has affected the economy at large, particularly in the tourism industry. It's now expected that Blair will announce an election date of June the 7th. For NPR News, I'm Mark Savage in London.
The United States has lost its seat on the United Nations Human Rights Commission. The United States is one of four candidates for three seats in its regional group. France, Austria, and Sweden each garnered more votes. It'll be the first time since the commission was formed in 1947 that the United States will not be represented on the 53-member commission. James Cunningham, the acting U.S. ambassador, said the loss of the election was disappointing. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Laura Linney isn't a flashy actress. Maybe that's why it took a while for her to achieve the recognition she deserves. But this year she received an Oscar nomination for her leading role in You Can Count on Me. Earlier, she co-starred with Clint Eastwood in Absolute Power, with Jim Carrey in The Truman Show, and with Richard Gere and Edward Norton in Primal Fear. Now she's returning to a role she originated 8 years ago in the series Tales of the City, the TV adaptation of Armistead Maupin's stories about the loves and adventures of a group of gay and straight friends in San Francisco in the mid-70s who form a kind of family with each other. The third cycle, Further Tales of the City, premieres on Showtime Sunday night. In Further Tales, the year is 1981. Linney's character, Marianne Singleton, has a job on a local TV station hosting the afternoon movie called The Bargain Matinee, for which she has to wear an usherette uniform and say inane things. In this scene, she tells her boss that she wants to move to the evening news.
Larry?
All right, you want to have a little talk. I think we can do that here just to save us both the time.
Well, it would only take...
The truth is, Marianne, you're a daytime face. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But the public doesn't want to see a daytime face on the 6 o'clock news. It's just that simple. I'm sorry, but that's the truth.
What about Bambi Kanataka?
What about her?
Well, she had a daytime show, and then you let her
do it. Bambi's GSRs went through the roof.
Well, test me then.
Well, we have tested you. Frankly, your GSR sucked. No one even broke a sweat.
Hi, people.
Hi, Bambi. Hey, just cut your promo. That was so cool. Can't wait to go and make those macaroni mirrors. You're in awfully early, aren't you?
Larry found some woman who used to date the Trailside Killer. Clever man.
So I got to do an interview. You know how it is.
Right.
Will you at least think about it?
I believe I already have.
Laura Linney, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
How has your character, Marianne Singleton, changed from the first episodes of Tales of the City to the current episodes?
Well, she's changed a lot, which is one of the great, you know, experiences of playing a role over such a long period of time. As many people know, Tales of the City, it was the first of six novels, and Further Tales, which is what's going to be airing in May on Showtime, is the third of those six. We did the second, More Tales of the City, a few years ago, also on Showtime. But Marianne, at the beginning of the story, the sort of canon, if that's sort of what a lot of people call it, of Tales, is a very naive young girl who's from Cleveland and makes her way to San Francisco to start a new life. And she arrives there in 1976 at the boom of what was then in San Francisco a very liberated time. And she finds herself in a world that she never expected, and it takes her a while to get her feet on the ground. She's very naive, easily embarrassed, gullible. And then in the second novel, she realizes that she can be comfortable there and starts to really enjoy it and, most importantly, enjoy herself. And then in the third novel, it goes one step further. She's more confident. She has a job that she's ambitious to improve upon. So the changes are radical. And for an actress to be able to continue a role over, what is it, almost 8 years now, is a rare opportunity, and it's been great fun.
I want to ask you about You Can Count on Me. You were nominated for Academy Award for Best Actress for your role in this. The story is about a two people, you and a character who plays your brother, you're both orphaned at a young age and have since headed in opposite directions. Your brother has become a wanderer, moving from town to town, state to state, and kind of irresponsible as well. You've stayed in the small town you grew up in and are a single mother, earning a living by working at the local bank as a lending officer. And although you seem like the very responsible one, you also do some pretty irresponsible things that seem inconsistent with your character. Mm-hmm. Let me play a scene from the film. In this scene, your brother Terry has just come back to town for the first time in several years. You've taken him to lunch at a nice restaurant. You're dressed in a nice skirt and blouse. Everything's well ironed. He's wearing an old T-shirt and jeans, which are fraying. Your brother is played by Mark Ruffalo.
I'm so glad to see you.
I'm glad to see you too, Sammy. So you're coming from work?
No, it's Saturday.
Yeah, no, it's just you're dressed so formally.
Oh, no. You know, I thought I'd... You know, I thought it was a special occasion, which it is, but...
Oh, that's good. No, that's good. I thought I'd get dressed up, too.
It's okay. You look fine.
Yeah, this is the haute cuisine of garments.
What?
Nothing. So, how are you?
I'm fine, Terry.
So, how's Rudy?
We're fine, Terry. How are you?
Yeah.
Where have you been lately, Terry?
No, I haven't been.
I got a postcard from you from Alaska?
Yeah, I was out there for a little while.
That was in the fall, Terry.
No, I've been out of touch. I
was a little worried. I mean...
Yeah, I've been a lot of different places. I was down in Florida for a little while. I was doing some work in Orlando. Man, I've been all over the place.
Well, I wish you'd just let me know you were okay.
Laura Linney, there's a lot of really incomplete sentences in this scene, much like in Real Conversation. Kenneth Lonergan, who wrote and directed the movie, has explained that he scripts in a lot of ums and ers and pauses within his screenplay. Can you talk a little bit about this scene and using the ums and the ers and the incomplete sentences and the pauses?
Sure. This scene, originally, Kenny wrote this particular scene, I think, 10 years ago as a one-act play. So it was really the genesis of the entire story. And then as the years went by, he just expanded it and it became the screenplay for You Can Count on Me. And Kenny's style with dialogue is extremely specific. It is littered with ums and ers and I mean and well and I don't know and stutters and stops and stop gaps and all of that, which... Once you learn it and sort of the rhythm of it gets into your body is very liberating, but it's hard to conquer at first, and was difficult for me in the beginning. And then once you get it, then it flows very easily, and it makes you better. Actually, it makes the character more complete. The rhythm of the scene moves the way that it's designed to, and that's the mark of a really great writer, is that they're also an architect. And each scene is structured and written in a lyric way so that it flows almost like a great piece of music. So all those ums and ers and all those frustrating little noises that we stammered and started through were very important.
Laura Linney is my guest, and she's starring in Further Tales of the City, the Armistead Maupin stories. Further Tales premieres this Sunday on Showtime. Now, your father is the playwright Romulus Linney. Although your parents divorced when you were young, I think you spent a fair amount of time with him when you were young?
Yes. Not an enormous amount, but certainly an important amount of time, and time that certainly bonded us deeply.
Did he take you to the theater a lot?
Yes, he did. And it was, you know, one of the great things about growing up in Manhattan, while no, you don't have the, you know, backyards and trees and carpools and all that, what you do have is the theater and museums and movies. And I was, my parents were wonderful in exposing me to all of that and really taking advantages of the resources that Manhattan has to offer. And I used to tag along with my father a lot to rehearsals and of productions of his own things, and also would go to the theater a great deal and loved it.
Now, this might be faulty memory, because I think the first time I interviewed your father, it was back in the late 70s, and he had a play in Philadelphia that had snakes in the title.
Yes, Holy Ghosts.
Holy Ghosts, yeah. And if my memory serves, which it might not, it had to do with a snake-handling religion. And
Pentecostal snake handlers, yes.
Good, and he had some kind of family connection with that, or at least geographical connection to it from his youth.
Well, our family's from the South, and you know, throughout the South, there always were Pentecostal snake handlers around. And I think, you know, deep religion, which is, you know, an extremely passionate thing to experience for those who do, I think fascinated my father, and faith and belief and distrust and trust. And I think those are all issues that are important to him. So, and I love that play. That's actually one of my favorites, and probably the one that I've seen the most. It's probably one of the ones I know the best.
I'm figuring that you were probably exposed to a lot of theater people when you were growing up, and a lot of theater people lead, you know, reasonably unconventional lives. I'm wondering if anything you were exposed to as a child in the lives of your parents, friends, seemed disturbing or seemed particularly appealing and exciting because they were so unconventional. Or maybe it all just seemed normal to you.
Well, I grew up with my mother and would visit my father on weekends. And when I would visit him, there would be artists who would come around for dinner or for, you know, drinks or cocktail hours they had in those days. And I just remember, you know, sort of wonderful earrings, women wearing huge, big, jangly earrings and fantastic. Carolyn Kaiser, I remember, came over with a fantastic belt. And I'll never forget the belt.
She's a great poet and translator.
She's a great poet. And so there were more literary people around than actual theater people. Not a lot of, a few actors and actresses every once in a while, but primarily more artists and poets. My father was at the McDowell Colony in Yaddo, which are artist colonies, excuse me. And he would spend many summers there. So friends who he would meet there would come to visit. But so it wasn't a deluge of artistic characters that I was around, though I would have loved to have been. But when I did meet them, I loved them. They were open and kind and interested in me, you know, which not all adults are interested in a small child. And so I loved it.
Laura Linney is my guest, and she's now starring in Further Tales of the City, based on the Armistead Maupin novel. It premieres Sunday on Showtime. She got an Academy Award nomination for her role in You Can Count on Me. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actress Laura Linney is my guest, and she's starring in Further Tales of the City, based on the Armistead Maupin novel, and it premieres Sunday on Showtime. She got an Academy Award nomination for her starring role in You Can Count on Me. Although you sound so comfortable and always have been so comfortable in the theater world, I also read that you had a stage fright when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
And the two seem...
Yeah, I went through a period of time. I went to Juilliard for graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
My third year there, I had a terrible bout of stage fright. And it was the first time in my life where I was uncomfortable in the theater. And it was heartbreaking to all of a sudden not feel at home when you were home. was very hard. And I contemplated stopping for a while and leaving school, but was able to work through it. But it was a really horrible phase, just enormous anxiety. You know, I'd walk off stage and burst into tears and be, you know, it was awful, and it was humiliating as well. And I was just acutely self-conscious and horribly uncomfortable. But fortunately, I worked through it and have actually spoken with a lot of other actors who have been through a similar thing. But It was certainly gut-wrenching, that's for sure. Well, I bought a lot of antacid during that period of time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there's any other medication or exercise that helped you through the period.
You know, antacid. You know, and, you know, I had twitches and acne, and, you know, all of us at Juilliard would go through phases of huge stress, and, you know, strange things would happen. But I had a professor who, John Sticks, who's a terrific teacher, and he had heard that I was really struggling. Everyone knew I was struggling. It was not a secret. And he pulled me aside to his office and said, so, you know, what's all this about? And I said, you know, John, I just don't know what to do, and I'm just having real doubts about myself and thinking maybe I should stop and maybe I, you know, shouldn't continue at school. And you know, he said, don't be silly. He said, you know, this is where you're supposed to fail. This is where it's safe to fail, and you should fail here. And that was helpful to hear. And he was right. You know, it's good to be bad at times. And that's been a lesson that I've really taken with me.
And I think your first Broadway role was as an understudy in Six Degrees of Separation as the Stockard Channing daughter character, the daughter of the Stockard Channing character. Is that right?
That is right. That was my first job.
First job?
It was pretty damn good for a first job.
But it always seems like an understudy is both a job and not a job at the same time because...
Oh, no, it's very much a job. It's a very specific skill, and it's very difficult. And I was, you know, the happiest understudy going. I was so thrilled to be a part of that group, to be a part of that group of people, to be associated with that play, to work at Lincoln Center, which was right across the street from school. I was happy as happy can be. But being an understudy is really difficult. It's a whole different skill. And I have tremendous respect and a huge gratitude for people who stand by or who understudy because it's difficult and, you know, terrifying.
What's the most difficult and terrifying parts of it?
Going on. I mean, actually going on. Because no matter how much you prepare, you usually don't rehearse with the company. You've never been in the costume. You've never felt the lights on you. You've rehearsed separately during the day with your fellow understudies. On a stage with no lights and you're wearing your jeans or whatever. So when you actually do go on, it's terrifying. It's a real leap of faith and takes enormous courage. And the people who are really good at it, those who understudy those big, huge parts, I just don't know how they do it. I made my off-Broadway and my Broadway debut understudying in that show when I went on. And the first time I went on, I had been studying the play for over a year at this point. I completely went up. I stood up to say my one line and, you know, two-thirds into the play, and I was like a deer in headlights. A light hit me in the eye that I had never felt before, and I had no idea where I was or who I was or what I was doing. All I knew was that there I was making my Broadway debut, and I didn't know what to say. So,
how'd you get out of that?
The other actor saved me. It was John Cameron Mitchell. God bless him. He just jumped right in and saved me. But
what did he do to save
terrible.
You?
Terrible. He just kept the scene going. You know, he just sort of jumped in and continued the dialogue so that it made sense. But I will never forget that. It was horrible. I felt about 2 inches tall. I was so embarrassed. I felt like I'd let everybody down. but it's just one of those things that happens.
Well, what would you do every night when the play was being performed on the nights that you weren't in it? Would you mouth your lines with your
character? I'd go up and sit in the catwalk, which is the gridding system above the audience and the stage where they hang the lights. I'd go and sit up there. And because I had been, worked technically in the theater when I was doing summer stock in New Hampshire, I was comfortable up there. I knew how to walk around those spaces and not be uncomfortable. I knew what the lights were, and I knew how to be safe up there. So I would crawl up in the catwalk and watch. And just, I never grew tired of watching that play. There's a monologue that John Cunningham, who's the male lead, who was in it, and I would just every night wait for that monologue because I thought it was so beautiful, talking about a Kandinsky painting and how artists can work so hard and can overwork a great piece of art to the point where they lose what in the monologue says, you lose the painting because you work so hard, you have this magnificent thing, and then you push it too far and you don't know when to stop and let go, and you overwork it and it sort of falls apart. And I always thought it was such a beautiful, beautiful monologue.
Now, you were nominated for an Oscar for Best Actress for You Can Count on Me. So you had to, you know, get the beautiful dress and you know, go to the designer and then have clips of you on the Joan Rivers and Melissa show of you in that beautiful dress. Mm-hmm. Just, I'm curious what that process is like to know that you have to go to a designer and choose the dress and everyone's going to talk about it and you might get really dished and you might get really praised and it'll all die out soon. But for a while, it's going to make news. What you wore is going to make
fair
news.
Game.
Exactly.
Yes, fair game. And, you know, it's now the fashion end of all of the award season. It is now a very important part of it. It's certainly not first and foremost on my mind. But the reality is that you are fair game out there. And I'm learning to enjoy it more, which I think is the most important thing. But I decided early on that this nomination meant a lot to me. And I was determined just to have a good time.
And how did you decide who to take with you?
I took Armistead Maupin with me.
Oh, did you? Oh, good.
I did. Armistead was my date.
I'll mention he does Further Tales of the City, which you're about to star in on Showtime. Okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
And Armistead and I have been friends since 1993 when we did the first Tales together, and I wanted to take someone who was a permanent person in my life. I wanted to share the evening with someone who, A, I knew would have a good time, B, would also not be overwhelmed by the evening, because it is overwhelming, all of the press, and being the date of a nominee is not easy. It's sort of a job within itself. You have to make sure the train is okay, and they're sort of there for you for support as well as their own enjoyment. So I wanted to take someone who I knew would be in my life, you know, for the rest of my life, and who I could share it with. So I wanted to make sure that it was a very, very, you know, a special person. Armistead was the perfect choice. And what I did throughout the award season was I took a special friend or someone who had done an enormous amount for me over time to each different event.
Was it good to take a gay friend, because that way there's not going to be rumors in the press about this affair that you're having?
Oh, that's right. Me and my many affairs. yes, I'm recently divorced as well. So, I took a lot of gay men to many of the events, actually, me and my gay friends. And we had a wonderful time. You know, when in doubt, take a gay friend.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Nice speaking with you, too.
Laura Linney stars in the new miniseries Further Tales of the City, based on the Armistead Maupin novel. It premieres Sunday night on Showtime. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Iranian filmmaker Bahman Farmanara tells us why he made a movie about his own funeral and wonders why the Iranian censors let him make it after rejecting 10 of his other screenplays. Also, Kevin Whitehead considers the music of pianist Cecil Taylor in part 4 of the series Avant-Garde Made Easy.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Iranian film director Bahman Farmanara has made his first movie in 20 years. Farmanara left Iran in 1980 after the Ayatollah Khomeini took power. After living in Canada for 9 years, he returned home. He tried to make movies when he returned, but Iranian censors rejected 10 of his screenplays. The one they finally let him make, Smell of Camphor, Fragrance of Jasmine, played the New York Film Festival and has begun to open theatrically in the U.S. Farmanara not only wrote and directed it, he stars in the film, playing a fictionalized version of himself. His character, a film director who hasn't made a movie in 20 years, has become preoccupied with death. His wife has died, and so have several of his filmmaker friends. He decides to make a movie about his own funeral. I asked Farmanara if he was ever forbidden to work in his country, whether his screenplays were just rejected one by one.
It's a gradual process. They try to make you tired. You hand in a script, and it takes about 8 to 9 months for them to say no, and it's always on a one-on-one basis when they call you in and verbally they tell you that the script is not approved. And very rarely they give any reasons for it, and because they don't feel obligated to give any reasons. And you feel that the 8 months of your time has been wasted, and it makes you depressed. And I gave 10 scripts before the 11th one was eventually approved. And I'll be damned if I could tell you why this last one was approved while the other 10 were refused, because censorship does not follow logic.
Have things become more liberal in Iran? Could it be attributed to that?
Yes, I think so. I think since the election of President Khatami, there has been an opening. We had a minister of culture, Dr. Mahajirani, who was a very courageous man, and he decided, you know, that some people should go to work and contribute to the society, because this arbitrary banning of writers, directors, painters, poets is just ludicrous.
If you don't mind my asking, I'm wondering why, after staying away from Iran for 8 or 9 years, living in Canada and the United States, why did you go back, knowing how difficult it would likely be for you to keep making films in Iran?
Well, initially, it was for personal reasons, because I'm the only son in the family. We are four brothers that had never worked with my father in the family business, which is textile. And one of my younger brothers had a heart attack, and my father called me, and for the first time in my life, he asked me for something and said, would you go back and help? And I thought that this will be for a year, maximum 2 years. So I said yes, and I went back. But during that 2 years that dragged on actually to be 3 and 4 and now is 10 years, not only I got involved with that business and I've been the CEO of the company also for the last 5 years, but at the same time I rediscovered my country at an age that I can't let it go. And most of my creative juices come from that culture and what I know about it and the people and the affection for the people that... About 65% of it is below the age of 25.
Right. So does that make you like an old man in their eyes?
Actually, I tell you an anecdote about... I was in a bookstore, and there are two young people, 18 and 19. They were buying a book about movies, Iranian movies. And I heard they mentioned my film, Prince Ertegab. And one of them said, yeah, he was a very good director, but too bad he died soon. and I was standing there. So because of that, I decided to go back to work. So when you think, you know, that because age is quite relative, I'm sure that I look like an old man in their eyes. But I'm going to hang around and teach them a few things.
Let me get back to your new movie, Smell of Camphor, Fragrance of Jasmine. You star in the movie. You wrote it, you directed it, and you star in it. Now, I understand you didn't initially plan to be the star, but the actor who was slated to play the leading role couldn't do the movie. What was the difference between how you envisioned the character looking and your playing the part?
Well, I had chosen actually a famous painter because I didn't want a professional actor to play the part. And we had done some tests, and he was very good, and his name is Aydin Ardoshlu. And I also use one of his most famous paintings in the film. I guess he got scared. About a week before the shoot, he called me one night and said he's not going to do it. And because he was not a professional actor, I didn't have any hold on him. And I've been friends with him for about 30 years. But if I had directed the film a year before, I probably would have postponed the shoot a couple of months till I find somebody else. We still, in 1 week that we were away from the shoot, we tested about 27, 28 other people, including myself. And eventually, looking at all of them, the crew and myself came to the conclusion that I have to play the lead. So it was one of those things. It made my work much harder, but it was not planned on, and I don't plan to play in any of my future films.
Oh, I think you're very good in this. I'm wondering why you didn't want a professional actor. What was your problem with professional actors? Why did you choose a painter instead?
Well, the professional actors and the choices that we have in Iran, the really, really famous ones that could fit the part, they are so identified with other parts that I think people would not have believed them in this particular part. And that was the reasoning behind it.
Now, in the movie, you play a film director who, like yourself, hasn't made a movie in about 20 years and is making one now. And he wants to cast an old actor friend of his in a part, and this actor friend hasn't worked in many years. I'm wondering if you had any actor friends who hadn't worked in many years who you gave parts to in this movie.
Unfortunately, no, because getting permission to work myself was such a task that I didn't want to jeopardize it by insisting to have an actor that was banned for also that many years, because each one of us have different battles. I'm hoping to have one of them to act in my next film, but I've requested permission for him to be able to work again. We're about a month and a half away from the shoot, and I still don't have a reply officially that he's allowed to work or not.
Boy, listening to you talk, I'm trying to imagine how frustrating and infuriating it must be to need permission to make a movie or to need permission to cast the actor or for that actor to need permission to work.
Well, it is very frustrating. And when my film was shown at the Tehran Film Festival and it was awarded, you know, so many awards and people were applauding and so on, I made a speech then and I said that I really missed the sound of applause and connecting to my own people. And at the same time that I was extremely happy, but I was also very furious because people behind closed doors had forced me not to have this contact and this pleasure of creating a work and also having a give and take with the audience. So it is very frustrating when you're working in that kind of a situation, but that's the way it is if you want to work in Iran, and each one of us have to fight it at each step.
My guest is Iranian film director Baman Farmanara. His new movie is called Smell of Camphor, Fragrance of Jasmine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Iranian film director Baman Farmanara. His new film, Smell of Camphor, Fragrance of Jasmine, is his first film in 20 years. Iranian censors rejected 10 of his screenplays before approving this one. When you were coming up with the idea for your new movie, did you consciously think, what kind of film can I make that they might let me make?
Well, the Smell of Camphor idea came at the end of the session that they had set up for refusing the 10th script. And I was so depressed. I thought, they're never going to let me work. And I thought, okay, I make a film about my own funeral. And that idea came and went at the end of that session. And after a couple of days of sleeping off the depression and trying to put myself together, then I decided actually to submit it as an idea. And lo and behold, it only took about a couple of days for them to approve this, and which really pushed me to ask them, is really the quickness of approval is because this story is about my death? and they really didn't appreciate the humor, but nevertheless, I think it had something to do with it. And it was so close to me that the person that was talking to me said, has your wife died? And I said, no. I said, but in the script you say that she's died. I said, well, it was the choice of her dying than sleeping with the chador next to me, and I thought that she should die is better. But they really thought it's the story of my life, and they said, okay, I'll let him make it. Nobody's going to see it. And they didn't think it was going to be successful, and all of those ideas or reasons were behind what they allowed the film to be made.
Well, you raise an interesting point. If the character's wife was alive in the movie, would she be sleeping in a body veil next to you?
Well, yeah, you have to. I mean, that is the law. And
the law for films, or is that the law
yes,
for?
No, it's the law for the film.
Right. Okay.
I mean,
just
obviously,
checking.
You know, obviously, your wife doesn't sleep with a body veil next to you, otherwise, no children would be made. But I think no, it's the law for the movies, and even the next film that I'm making, the wife now has left him and has gone outside of Iran, so I eliminate the women in personal situations while we have contact with them outside of home, because then again, you know, the attire is completely according to the laws of the, you know, we have to obey.
No, there's a scene in the movie that I want to ask you about. There's a scene where a young woman is basically hitchhiking with an infant in her arms, and your character picks her up. And after she leaves, he finds that she left the baby, which is actually dead, in the backseat of the car, wrapped in plastic with the placenta. It's, needless to say, a very disturbing experience for him. Is this something that happened to somebody you know?
Well, this actually happened to me about 30 years ago. About 8 years before the revolution, I was going somewhere very early in the morning during the winter, and I passed through a street that there is a children's hospital there. And a woman is standing by the side of the road, and she was carrying a baby, and I gave her a ride. And I asked her, you know, where are you going? And she said, to the cemetery. And I say, why? I said, because the baby is dead. And I said, where is your husband? And she said, with the other six. And it destroyed my whole day, and it remained in the back of my mind for so many years. And when I was writing this particular script one night, you know, this woman appeared. And in my film, really, she represents the mothers, the young mothers of today, because the children have no future, and they are as if they are stillborn. And you know, versus the mother that, you know, the woman that plays my mother, which is, we call it the mother of the country that does not remember us anymore.
Because your mother has Alzheimer's in the movie.
That's right.
No, okay, so the way you see this movie, this young woman who your character picks up, her dead baby represents the lack of a future that children coming into the world in Iran have today. Do you think the censors got that point when they were reading your screenplay?
I don't think so. I don't think so, and I don't explain it, you know.
No, you don't.
In Iran. The fact of the matter is that scene is so gripping that everybody was surprised why I wasn't going back to it during the rest of the film. But that's the whole trick. We have an incident that is very moving, and we just move along to other incidents that happen. And no, they didn't pick it up. But the woman, for that 4 minutes, she got the Best Supporting Actress Award.
Really?
Yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bahman Farmanara, and his new movie is called Smell of Camphor, Fragrance of Jasmine. He's Iranian, and this movie was made in Iran. It's opening in some theaters in the United States. What movies did you grow up with in Iran?
Well, in Iran, mostly American films. I left Iran when I was 16 and went to England to acting school, and then to USC in Southern California and went to film school. But up to the age of 16, what we saw, there were mostly American films. The things that I remember is East of Eden of Elia Kazan. I remember On the Waterfront and, of course, Gone with the Wind and some Japanese films, but not that many. But mostly there were American films.
Do you get to see many movies in Iran now? What plays there now?
Well, foreign films, actually, they don't play there. And in the last 10 years that I've been back to Iran, four American films have been shown. Last Emperor, Dances with the Wolves, Seven.
Seven?
And Fargo.
Wait a minute. Seven is a really dark, violent movie. It's...
Well, because, you know, they refer to
it's about a serial
picture
killer
of America, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So the idea is this is what America's like, a lot of really sick serial killers.
Exactly. And I think there is no sense to it, but that's the four films that they've released.
Well, if that's their attitude, there's a whole lot of movies they could show. I mean, really.
Well, you know, they're not that open, but I don't know who chooses these films. I understand the reasonings behind it. It's very pretty much like Soviet Russia when they used to choose films that showed the racial problems in the United States. Those were preferred films.
Now, is it okay for you to talk like this on American media and then go home back to Iran?
Look, I'm 59 years old. I don't have too much time for silence.
And is there a difference to what you can say here and what you could say there?
Most of the things that we're talking about, I've already talked about in Iran as well. So it's nothing new because I'm considered one of those few directors that actually does speak his mind. And so be it, you know, what is going to happen? Another 10 years of not working?
Right. Well, I'm sure you wouldn't want that.
No, I don't want that, and I don't, go after it. But at the same time, you know, as long as we discuss, we can discuss different matters and criticize and point to some mistakes that are being made, I don't see any reason to be in communications if you don't want to talk about these things. Some of my friends, for example, they say, my films are not political. I say, well, that comment in itself is political. Because in a society that politics rules everything, when you say my films are not political, you are making a political statement nevertheless.
Well, thank you for talking with us, and I wish you good luck.
Thank you very much.
Bahman Farmanara wrote, directed, and stars in the new movie Smell of Camphor, Fragrance of Jasmine. It's already opened in New York, opens in Los Angeles this weekend, and will open in other cities over the next few weeks. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead's series Avant-Garde Made Easy continues with the music of Cecil Taylor. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is playing and discussing the music of a half dozen modern jazz mavericks in his series Avant-Garde Made Easy. Today, part four, the music of Cecil Taylor. When jazz fans think of Cecil Taylor, they often think of music like that, busy, dissonant, and lightning fast. Taylor was one of the founders of the free jazz movement. He's still active, and 45 years after his debut, is still sometimes accused of being a musical anarchist. Kevin Whitehead says Taylor is a virtuoso pianist who can articulate complex runs so quickly his hands blur before your eyes. But his music has more sides than that.
Cecil Taylor, 1998. He doesn't always breathe fire, but from his earliest to relatively conservative records with swinging rhythm sections, he didn't sound like a typical jazz pianist. On a 1959 version of Cole Porter's Get Out of Town, you can hear glimpses of his mature style ahead. Obsessive variations on tiny figures, sudden shifts between loud and soft notes, and dense chords that reflect his youthful admiration for Dave Brubeck. By 1963, Taylor led a trio without a bassist, and including a drummer whose rhythm was as free as his own, Sonny Murray. But Taylor was still in transition. His left hand might play a simple, if fragmented, riff, while his right scattered notes like confetti. Soon after that, Cecil Taylor really came into his own as pianist, and in terms of developing his material in an individual way. When Taylor rehearses musicians, he may teach them short themes that he never plays verbatim on the gig. Instead, he may stud his improvisations with fragments or suggestions of those themes in any key. You can hear the seeds of that practice on 1966's Unit Structure for Septet. Early on, Taylor plays a themelet, which alto saxophonist Jimmy Lyons immediately paraphrases in a lower key, by which time Taylor has already moved on. Later, Taylor plays various near and far permutations of that figure, which sometimes cue the improvisers to refocus their energy or set off on a new tangent. That brief glimpse only hints at Cecil Taylor's working method. For the curious, there's a detailed analysis of unit structure in Ekkehard Joost's fine book, Free Jazz, which deciphers the musical logic behind the 1960s avant-garde. It can be easier to hear what Taylor is up to on some of his solo recitals. He begins the 1973 album, Indent, with two almost identical seven-note phrases, the second answering the first. Such call and response has been a staple of African-American music since slaves first shouted to each other across the field. Taylor works instant variations on those figures, tinkering with the timing, displacing a note, or extending a phrase and gradually transforming it. That's pretty straightforward, by Taylor standards at least. By contrast, his group music grew ever more intense, calling for quick thinking and quick fingers. Taylor and saxophonist Jimmy Lyons, his musical partner from the early 1960s until Lyons died in 1986, had an uncanny way of complementing each other's lines, taking small scraps of melody and running with them. The music sounds frenetic on the surface, but they stayed focused on the material at hand. On this slice of a 1981 concert, the bassist is William Parker, another longtime and reliable collaborator. The drummer is Rashid Bakar. Granted, Cecil Taylor's music can seem intimidating. It's not really so hard to follow, but because he makes up his own rules, it does demand your attention. Some critics dismiss his music as not jazz, as if stuff that doesn't fit neatly into a category is beneath consideration. That's foolish reasoning. But even so, this propulsive, improvisational music, awash in African-American aesthetics, sure sounds like jazz to me.
Kevin Whitehead is currently based in Chicago. This week, Cecil Taylor is Distinguished Artist in Residence at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Next week, Kevin continues his series Avant-Garde Made Easy with saxophonist Albert Eiler. The series is produced by Roberta Furrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Tulip Fever by Deborah Moga, a novel about the tulipomania set in 17th century Amsterdam. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ruth Reichel, the editor-in-chief of Gourmet and former New York Times restaurant critic. She has a new memoir. Also, Steven Greenberg, the documentary about his father, Hank Greenberg, the first Jewish baseball star, is playing on Cinemax this month. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.